Bonjour, and welcome to the second lesson. Thank you for continuing to come back to normal life and not Zooming, or now there's hybrid conferences. We are just in person, so courage. Last week, we discussed the relations between Egypt and the Levant, and we discussed the empire, the Egyptian empire. And just a little recap, if you want, yes? So when Egypt is referred to as an empire, it's always in relation to the Late Bronze Age, yes? To the New Kingdom, roughly the New Kingdom in Egypt. And you can see some of the major publications on this issue of the New Kingdom in Egypt, and you see the discourse, yes? So Ellen Morris, The Architecture of Imperialism, Military Bases and the Evolution of Foreign Policy. Then there are also discussions on the southern side of this empire. The Egyptian Empire is not just an empire in Western Asia, it's also an empire in Northern Africa, so in Nubia, yes? So the first colonial empire, Egypt, and in Nubia. And lately also the publication by Do Koch on the Egyptian network in colonial encounters. So again, all this terminology relates to the New Kingdom era. But then this imperial discourse completely changes, okay? So when we discuss the next period in Egyptian history, the third intermediate period, you will notice already a change of tone. This is already after the empire. So if you look at Aidan Dodson, afterglow of empire. So, you know, nobody thinks of Egypt anymore at this time as an empire. And this is something that I would like to contend with today in my lecture. Okay, because the idea is that Egypt in the third intermediate period is this very fragmented state with different centers of power, that it is weak, and most of all that it is confined to Egypt, and it doesn't have, you know, serious relations with anyone outside of Egypt. And this perceived or alleged confinement is exactly the reason for my personal confusion or bafflement, because I can see a very wide variety of visual, textual, and ideological expressions of Egypt in the Iron Age Southern Levant, and they are quite obviously affected by Egyptian culture. And if this is no longer an empire, then what is it? How do I define, yes, these attestations of intercultural exchanges? So I will show you some of the details of this Egyptian influence as time permits, okay? And by no means is this a comprehensive list. It's just to show the variety, okay, of how these things look. So the first period of the Iron Age we discussed last week. I'll just go over it shortly, yes? This is the early Iron Age. This is the 11th or 10th, early 10th century BC. And we have mostly in southwestern Canaan, okay, what is sometimes called Philistia, but in effect is larger than Philistia, because if we talk about Philistia in the Bible, we're talking about the five Philistine city-states, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gat. But actually this phenomena is a wider regional from about the Yarkon River to the south. And in this region we see pottery, local pottery, which is inspired by Egyptian motifs, such as the lotus flower that we discussed last week. This lotus flower also appears on bowls that we find in Philistia or in southwest Canaan. We see the Nilotic scenes on the ivories. Again, we saw this example, and we also saw the original, yeah, from Tanis, okay? And the conoid seals, or the multifaceted seals, that have iconography of Amun-Re and also the hieroglyphic writing of Amun-Re, but in a very local execution, no doubt. So we talked about this. At the same time, in the coastal areas of Israel, above the Yarkon River, so to the northwest of Israel, we find Egyptian imports. And not just imports, but large pottery storage jars. So this is a standard 65 centimeters, okay? They're all very standardized, which implies some kind of maritime shipping. And this is bigger, this is about 75 centimeters. And they're all stored together, for example, in Tel Dor, okay? This is just south of Haifa. In Tel Kassile, which is basically where Tel Aviv is, okay? It's where the University of Tel Aviv is, on the same hill. On the banks of the Yarkon River, which goes into the sea in Tel Aviv. So these big jars of Egyptian product, okay? There's no doubt that they come from Egypt. It's very easy to identify the pottery itself, the sherds, as Egyptian. Also, from just looking at them, they are very different than the material that we see in Tel Dor, in Tel Kassile, the local kind of pottery, ceramics. But also in Tel Dor, there has been a large project of petrography. Okay, this is the process we discussed a little bit. I mentioned it last week, where you look at the actual inclusions and the minerals and the geological sediments inside the pottery. And then you can say, okay, this is pottery from the Nile. Okay, it does not come from anywhere else. So also in Tel Dor, there was a big petrographic project, and it's all very clearly from Egypt. So this commercial exchange with Egypt continues in the Iron Age. However, and also we have smaller containers also from Tel Kassile, okay? These are about, this is actually very big. It's about 70 centimeters, it's about 50 centimeters. Also found together with the other storage containers. So this is something that is coming together. Interestingly to note, okay, where now we can look in the early Iron Age at Israel, and we can see that in the southwestern part, we don't have Egyptian imports. Hardly any. There's one jar maybe in Ashkelon. But we have a lot of Egyptian influence on the iconography. And in the northwestern part, in Tel Dor and Tel Kassile and other places that have Egyptian imported pottery, we have the imports, but no one is using the iconography. Okay? So where there is import, there is no influence. And when where there is influence, there is no import. And again, this is a very interesting equation that I am presenting here today. As we move on to the second phase of the Iron Age 2A, the early part of it. So this is called early Iron 2A in the periodization of archaeology of Israel. We find that along this Egyptian imports that continue in coastal sites, as we go inland, we find Egyptian pottery that is locally produced. Okay, so this is not an import. This is locally produced, and it looks exactly like Egyptian pottery in Egypt. And this was a phenomenon that we know from the imperial period, from the late Bronze Age. We talked about it last week, when in much larger quantities and a very strong phenomenon of just simple Egyptian ware. You know, we talked about the bowls, okay, and the jars. This is the base of a beer jar. And this was a phenomenon in the late Bronze Age where you had this kitchenware all over Israel. But then when you move into the Iron One, they disappear and they reappear in the Iron 2A, in the early Iron 2A. So this is from Afek. This is a very, quite big and deep bowl, very Egyptian in style. This is the base of a beer jar. So you have to imagine, okay, something like this. And it's, you see, very crude, okay? It's a, it's an Egyptian class of vessels that was used, that was handmade, not on a wheel, okay? And it was never finished nicely because it was just made for preparing beer from grain or preparing bread, okay, from grain. So we find this, of all places, in Tel Masos. Tel Masos is a very important site in the Be'er Sheva Valley, so in the south of the country, okay, in an area that during the previous Late Bronze Age, New Kingdom, Egypt, had nothing to do with anyone, okay? People hardly lived there, and the Egyptians definitely did not venture into there. We will talk more about what is Tel Masos and what's happening in the south in our fourth and last lesson. Another thing that we find are those spinning bowls. So spinning bowls, here is a complete profile of the spinning bowl. You see, it has these little handles inside. The handles are used to create threads. So you put all your linen, your flax, inside. You add water and you start pulling through the handles in order to make a thread, a textile thread. And this is a technique that was already in, it was invented in Egypt and moved to the Levant already in the previous period, in the Late Bronze Age, under imperial rule. And then we had this kind of bowls. This is from Beit She'an. But then in the Iron Age, we start finding these, this is a piece of a bowl, yes? The sides are missing. We start finding them in the same areas of the Yarkon River and inside the country. And something interesting, because you can say, okay, this is a continuation of a practice that was already introduced during the imperial era to Canaan, and now they are continuing. But something interesting happened. If you see, this and this are different typologically. What do I mean? This has a base, a round base. We call it a ring base, okay? And in the Iron Age, all the spinning bowls have a ring base. Okay, very beautiful. In the Late Bronze Age, they do not have a ring base, they have a flat base. Now, this happens contemporaneously in Egypt and in Canaan. So this is a typological development that happens in the Third Intermediate Period in Egypt and in the Iron Age in ancient Israel or Canaan. And so you know that this is not just a local development, it is connected to some kind of technological advancement in Egypt. It's something that is contemporaneous. So in the early Iron Age, we have these additions. And if we have a look for a moment at the map of how this Egyptian pottery is found in Iron Age Southern Levant, so you can see the red dots, yeah? So let's start with the yellow dots. The yellow dots are just the places where we found Egyptian pottery in the Iron Age I. And then the red dots are also in the Iron Age II, okay? We see in Tel Masos, also in Tel Esdar, a small site next to it, both in the Be'er Sheva Valley, Afek and Gezer in the central Shefela, and also Achziv, Atlit, and Endor. Of course, it also continues into the Iron Age. And maybe as a continuation of this phenomenon here in the Be'er Sheva Valley, also in Kadesh Barnea, which is, you know, Sinai, the end of the Negev, but now, of course, it's not under Israel's sovereignty. It was excavated when Sinai was under Israeli rule, and afterwards, it was all the material was returned to the Egyptians in the peace agreements, but it was published, so we have the data. Just have a look at this for a moment, because if you open one of the classical books on Pottery of the Holy Land by Ruth Amiran, okay, which is really like the Bible of pottery for any archaeologist working in the southern Levant, then you will see there that there is no Egyptian pottery in the Iron Age in Israel. Okay, so this is something that we as archaeologists believe for a long time because this is what we were taught. And then following my research, but also other people, we realized that we now have a nice map, not a lot of pottery, but some. And it is because this book of Ruth Amiran did not have Egyptian pottery in it, that many items were not identified as Egyptian in the original excavations. So for example, the bowl that I found in Gezer was not identified in the publication. In the publication, it was written unidentified. Okay, they did not have what to compare it with because you open Ruth Amiran and you say there's no Egyptian pottery in Israel in the Iron Age, so you don't find it. So this is just to show how paradigms change and how they shift. And now we have really all the parallels. So I start getting phone calls, you know, from someone, Sam Wolf, who is excavating in Shuni, a very small burial cave. And he calls me up and he says, well, you know, I remember you showed these bowls. I have a bowl here that looks like it. You know, probably it's Egyptian. I go and see it. I say, yeah, it's Egyptian. You know, okay. So this is how things change and research advances. Okay, moving on to the late. Yeah, this was the early Iron 2A. We are going into the late Iron 2A, to the 9th and 8th centuries before a rest. And here we have a very interesting phenomena, which would require a lesson of its own or even a seminar of its own. Okay, the ivories of Samaria, found in a royal context in Samaria, the capital of ancient Israel. And this is a collection, an assemblage of many pieces, small, large. Some of them are inlays, some of them are parts of furniture, some of them are little statuettes. And most of them are in this style, which is heavily influenced by Egyptian and or Phoenician Egyptian, okay? And this is why I said that this could be the topic of a whole seminar, because when you look at this, of course you see the lotus flower, okay? And above it, you see the child. And this is a child according to Egyptian iconography because he is naked. And this is how in Egyptian conventions you say that this is a child. And because he has his finger in his mouth. Okay? So this is how we know a child in Egyptian iconography. He's naked and he has his finger in his mouth. And usually also he's shaved, but for one lock of hair. Okay, so this is usually Horus the child. And here it is another child deity, Nefer Atum, which is coming from the lotus, is sitting on the lotus. Everything about this is Egyptian, the attributes that the deity is holding, the crown on the head, the special crown. But so if I didn't know anything about Phoenicia, I would look at it and say, okay, this is Egyptian. But then we go to Phoenician ivories and we see that there is this kind of iconographical language that is used in Byblos, in Phoenicia, and we have these ivories there, and it's actually even wider phenomenon that even goes to Mesopotamia. But following some work that was done by Christoph Ullinger and Sotter, we can say today that Samaria had its own workshop of ivories. So the ivories that were produced in Samaria are slightly different than the ones that were produced in Phoenicia and elsewhere. And so this resurfaces the question of the Phoenician or Egyptian influence on this type of artifact. Whatever the result may be, and I don't think that anyone can at this point in time give a concrete decision, okay, whether it's this Phoenician or Egyptian influence. It is the Egyptian world. It is the Egyptian visual language, okay, that is also ruling in Phoenicia and is also ruling in Samaria. And the fact that we have two different interpretations of this visual language, one in Byblos and one in Samaria, can tell us that this is an Egyptian or language that is being reinterpreted in different places of the world. It's an Egyptian idea, it's an Egyptian culture, it's an Egyptian cultic figure which is being reshaped in different parts of the world. So that's it. The other thing that sort of relates to the question that I just asked, are the ivories more Egyptian or more Phoenician, is the appearance of hieratic numerals on the ostraca in Samaria and also in other places in Israel. So ostraca are those little bits and sherds. I'm afraid I don't have a picture here, but yes, this is the note of the ancient world. Yes, if you want to write a little note to someone, you just take a piece of broken pottery and you use some ink and you write, okay, this and this gave me two camels on the day of this and that. Thank you, this is your receipt. And they were really mainly used for commercial exchanges. And then when you look at the numbers, and this is a work done by Wimmer in his PhD, you see that the script is, of course, local, it's Hebrew, but the numerals are using the Egyptian hieratic system. Hieratic is the shorthand of Egyptian. And at the same time in Phoenicia, we have different hieratic numbers that are being used, okay? The Phoenicians. So there is kind of a, you know, why am I using the numbers that are used in Egypt and not in Phoenicia? Maybe because I am more influenced by this Egyptian world. Okay. Some things appear on the road from Iron 1 to Iron 2. Okay, they're not so exact that I can say only Iron 1, only Iron 2. For example, these post-Ramesside seals, okay, we discussed them also in the previous lesson. I said they appear in Southwest Canaan, but they also appear in other places of the country and eventually all over the Eastern Mediterranean. Okay, so they are seals that there is also a kind of disagreement about their place of production. So this is why I say peut-être un peu de production locale. They are very Egyptian, but some of them have also Canaanite iconography. So perhaps it's a bit of both, okay? Like usually when we have in Egypt. Another thing which you will find almost always when you excavate the layers of the Iron Age, you will always, always, always find these little Egyptian amulets, okay? This is the Pataikos, and this is the Isis nursing the baby Horus, but we have also just women deities, figurines that could be either Isis, they could be Mut, and of course the Wadjet eye and the Bes figurines and the little amulets. If you want, there is a very big catalog by Ehrman. I will upload the bibliography to the site of the college later on, and you can see we are now at 4 volumes. There will be more, and it's a lot of material. And this has always been this question, okay, we have these Iron Age, Israelite, Judahite sites. What are all these Egyptian deities doing there, okay? All these amulets. I hope we can get to a little bit of an answer to that by the end of this lesson today. And another very important aspect of the late Iron Age, Iron 2B, and iron to sea. So this is the 8th and the 7th centuries before Christ, is the ceilings that we find. We have quite a few Egyptian motifs that we find either on pottery, big jars like this one. So you see they have four, there's another handle on the other side. So they have four handles because they're very big jars and you don't want to break them when you take them up. And the handles are very usually stamped. They're usually stamped with what is called lamelech, to the king, okay, of the king. But we'll see that in a moment. Before that, I want to say something about the lesser known stamps of the horse, which Stefan Munger has shown that it is an Egyptian original that is being used here in Judah, especially. And another kind of seals are bone seals. So bone seals made of bone, of animal bone. We used to think they were ivory. Now we know that a lot of the ivory that we find in archaeological excavations, both late Bronze Age and Iron Age, are in fact bone and not ivory. But these ivory seals, they look like a scarab, okay, or a scaraboid. Yes, this is the same kind of shape. And on their base, we find many times a very crude schematic image next to a cartouche. So a cartouche is this oval frame in which the Egyptians write the name of a king. And these bone seals are very famous because they have sometimes very crude Egyptian hieroglyphs like this one, and this is sh. And sometimes there is another sh on the seal, and then it's shi, sha, k, or sheshank, the very famous Egyptian king who is mentioned in the Bible and will be the topic of our last lesson. So these bone seals have been known in scholarship to be referred to as Sheshank seals in Judah. Well, Egyptologists are a little bit less enthusiastic to call it Sheshank. It's true that some of them have the sheen, but some of them have other words or signs, hieroglyphic signs, inside the cartouche. What is clear is it is Egyptian inspired. It's clear that it is locally produced. It's not something from Egypt. And it's clear that we find it all over Judah in this time. Okay? And the ceilings, okay? Sometimes we find the seal and sometimes we find the ceiling, okay? The result of the seal. So, of course, this is a very famous ceiling of the Judahite king, Hezekiah, and found in the city of David. And you will notice immediately, I think, that you have the winged sun disk, a very known Egyptian motif, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And here on the side, we have the hieroglyph for life, Ankh. Now, when you look into the corpus of Hebrew seals, and again, this is another lecture of itself that we can do. The corpus of Hebrew seals, because this is written on it in Hebrew, yes? The corpus of Hebrew seals and sealings is full of hieroglyphs, all kinds of hieroglyphic signs, and they are good hieroglyphic signs. Sometimes I see that in scholarship, people will write pseudo-hieroglyphs. They are not pseudo-hieroglyphs. They are good hieroglyphic signs that were written by someone who knew what they meant and knew how to write them, knew how to shape them. And so they are full of hieroglyphic signs, not just the Ankh. Of course, the problem with this corpus of West Semitic Hebrew seals is that most of them come from the antiquities market, and only very few come from an excavation. This one came from an excavation, the city of David. So this was a good break. This was a lucky break, because if I see this coming from the city of David, then I know that many other seals that have hieroglyphic signs on them are comparable to this, okay? So not all of them should be considered as fakes, but we have to consider them very carefully, of course. Now we go to the big issue of ceilings on pottery. This is what we call lamellech storage jars. Again, they are typical for Judea in the 8th and 7th century. They come in hundreds of specimens. And on the handle, we usually see a ceiling of that says lamellech. Here we will turn it over as it should be. And lamellech would be to the king. And then we have this. And this is the sign of a sun, a solar disk with wings. And let's just see for a minute. We have this map here to show you how many of them have been found and where, all over Judea. And we have the sign of the solar disk with wings, but we also have scarabs with four wings. Okay, you see this here? It's a scarab. It has two wings facing upwards and two wings facing downwards. So we have a few symbols on this iconography of those storage jars that go to the king. And this is another point of contention, which we really have to ask ourselves, where is all this symbolism coming from? Tala Yornan, a specialist in iconography of the ancient Near East, wrote an article that, in her opinion, this comes from the Mesopotamian world. And this has been already part of the iconography of the Levant already from earlier times, from the late Bronze Age, possibly even the Middle Bronze Age. And so she sees this as a continuation of this iconography. Of course, there's also the four-winged scarab, which we should find something else for. And when you look at the Hezekiah seal of this solar disk with the wings, this is, for me, a different, but very clear, Behedet, the sign of the Horus of Edfu, which appears almost on every Egyptian stela from the late Bronze, New Kingdom and Iron Age, and also appears in different kinds of ways on scarabs. Here, for example, this is the scarab from Egypt. We see the beetle with the wings. So we have here a kind of mystery. Where is this really coming from, this influence on the Judahite seals? Is it Egyptian? Is it Assyrian? And, I can maybe talk about this a little bit more later. But I'm sure that we can agree that there is some of both. And at the end, there's also the hieroglyphs. So the symbolic language on this seal, for example, for me, is Egyptian because it has the hieroglyphs, and as do many other Hebrew seals. Okay, so this was a little bit on the details, yes? What do we see? What do we expect to see in Iron Age Israel? And now we can come back to the question of what does it mean? How to give a framework to understand all these little bits and pieces of Egyptian culture. And by the way, I haven't even discussed beyond Israel, yes? Because, okay, not an empire, then what is it? Okay. We have in Jordan, we have a continuation of these Egyptian anthropoid coffins. We have also in Jordan this stela from Balwa, which uses a kind of combination of Egyptian iconography, deity iconography, and maybe something more local in the iconography. And of course, we have in Byblos the statues of Egyptian kings of the 22nd dynasty. So there's a statue of Sheshonq I, there's a statue of Osorkon I, and of Osorkon II. So I'm not going into that at the moment, but this is just to say that when we look at Judah and Israel, they are not alone in this Egyptian influence. They're also surrounded by it. And now we also have new evidence from Arabia, from Teme, that gives us also the Egyptian influence there in the Iron Age. Okay, and in passing, maybe I should also mention that the Bible, yes, Egypt had also a huge impact on the Hebrew Bible, and this is something that we will talk more about in the next lesson, which will be devoted to this. So, you know, the text of the Iron Age, in which Egypt is really mentioned many, many times. But beyond that, you know, various passages have been recognized as directly inspired from Egyptian texts, Proverbs and Job and Psalms. And it's clear that the biblical text has some kind of ambiguous perspective on Egypt as it turns from a place of refuge to a place that you flee from. So we'll talk about this more next lesson, but just to say that when we're looking at all these pieces of the puzzle, of the Egyptian puzzle in Iron Age Southern Levant, this is also part of it, because this was definitely composed sometime in the Iron Age Levant. So I've been studying the relations between Egypt and the Levant for more than a decade now, and always finding these bits and pieces all the time, more and more and more and more. And it seemed to me that sometimes maybe the most significant Egyptian impacts on the Levant came in periods that did not exhibit equally significant relations between the two regions, like we just saw. And we talked a little bit about this, that some have considered these kind of influences as post-colonial responses, and some as the result of officials and craftsmen that stayed in the Levant after the empire, for example. And of course, while this may explain the early Iron Age, it does not explain the later Iron II, and especially the Iron IIb, the 8th century. This was supposed to be the Assyrian century, the 8th century. Instead, we see an intensification of Egyptian traditions and style. And it's true that we can also find here in Gunther's view that this intensification of Egyptian style was a kind of response to the reshaping of West Asia by Assyrian Empire. Okay, but this doesn't explain everything in the record. And we also have the Phoenician examples, yes, where contemporaneous similarities of craft, technology, and motifs may be explained by the mobility of craftsmen or of Phoenicians in Egypt. But this doesn't explain this phenomenon in other non-Phoenician areas, such as Israel and Jordan. And Phoenician trade was also considered to be the promoter for this wide adoption of Egyptian culture across the Eastern Mediterranean, particularly following maybe the Egyptian campaign of Sheshonq I, but we'll talk about it later. But the only evidence we have for this trade is, like we showed, from Tel Dor and Tel Kasile. And this is again more relevant for the Iron I and the early Iron IIa, and less relevant for the later phases, especially the 8th century. And so none of these models can really explain the Egyptian influence on the royal iconography in Israel and Judah, and on the Egyptianized culture of northern Jordan, for example, or the Arabian Peninsula. So I'm seeking for a different model of interaction. And I started to think what it means to be an empire. Does it necessitate an actual territorial occupation? So in their book Sensation from 2000, authors Michael Hart and Antonio Negri redefine empire in its modern virtual state as a new form of sovereignty that emerged after the Second World War and in fact rules over major parts of the world through supranatural organizations. It relies on a few conditions: a globalized community, and creates an impact that is not only economic one, but also a cultural one. Cultural imperialism in this modern sense is usually considered with regard to the United States, and on that the book was of course written, and on the cultural impact of the United States on the world. America has become an idea, a fantastical place that some parts of the world look at and draw their concepts from. It is usually thought that these ideas spread through popular media, first the film industry, then the television, and finally the internet and social media. There's no doubt that this is a new concept. But several occasions of what I like to call quasi-empire, empire in the sense of Hart and Negri, so several occasions of quasi-empire have been known to occur in earlier history. Because cultural imperialism does not need modern media in order to exist. For example, before the age of America, certain parts of the world regarded French culture as the ultimate manifestation of Western civilization. In 19th century and early 20th century, in Romania, for example, children were sent to local French grammar schools so that they can be versed in sophisticated culture. The Francophone culture of Romania presents an interesting case of cultural imperialism, as Romanian intellectuals sought to define their identity not only as Western European, but also as not Ottoman and not Serbian. So what France was to Eastern Europe before the mass communication revolution, America is to large parts of the present globe. French people excluded, I hope so. We are not looking there. It is my contention that similar phenomena, albeit in smaller scales and only partially fulfilled, occurred in the ancient world in areas and eras that created similar conditions. The southern Levant, between the end of the Egyptian hegemony and the beginning of the Persian one, was such a time. And in the words of Hart and Negri from the 2000 book, we can catch glimpses of ancient empires as well. Yeah? The imperial order is formed not only on the basis of its powers of accumulation, we'll talk about that, global extension, but also on the basis of its capacity to develop itself more deeply, to be reborn, and to extend itself throughout the biopolitical latticework of world society. So I underlined these elements, okay, and they all manifest themselves to a certain degree in how Egypt of the first millennium BCE was perceived by and interacted with the southern Levant. So let's elaborate a little bit on them. But we have to bear in mind that when we take the idea of cultural empire, we have to take special care when discussed in relation to the ancient Near East. Okay? So if we look at globalization, for example, yeah? A term which, simply put, describes the fact that we all use the same technology, tools, decorative style, etc. So this appears to be a prerequisite for cultural imperialism. But it's, as such, it is a modern phenomenon, seemingly unrelated to the ancient world. But you already know that this is not true. Because contrary to common belief, international networks in the ancient Near East were geographically widespread and extremely efficient already in ancient times. As is proven time and time again by the discovery of materials and technologies far away from their original birthplace. So if we just cite a few, you know, researchers from the few years back, we have the finding of a banana in Tel Erani, okay, in the Iron One. We have what we call this international culture of ivories. We have spices from Southeast Asia that are now beginning to be found in late Bronze and Iron Age Southern Levant. Yes, so this article from 2015 found cinnamon, and there has just been another article from 2020 that found vanilla in late Bronze Age Megiddo, so even earlier. So we have a spice root that is earlier by a millennia of what we actually know of spice roots. Yeah? We have copper from Fainan, which was found in Greece. Okay? And also compared to copper that was found on the Lebanese coast. So we have these huge exchange systems. And of course, we must bear in mind that when we are dealing with the pre-modern world, global does not mean the entire globe. It means the entire system of ancient Near East, but now also ancient Southeast Asia. And I'm sure that in time we will find, as we have the ability to trace materials in archaeological finds, this is a new ability. We never could find cinnamon, of course. You know, we only find the molecule of cinnamon that was extracted from pottery. Yeah? So she will show you what we're talking about. Yeah? So when we finally have the ability, we will find many more materials that come from very far away. The cinnamon in these flasks, okay? These are vessels that are very unique. Mostly they are decorated, so it's like, you know, a special thing that you bring or that you have. And using petrography, so just, no, not petrography, sorry. Using residue analysis, so you're actually taking a little piece from the bottom of the vessel where the liquids have concentrated in ancient times. You're taking a little piece of the pottery, you crush it, and then you put it in several machineries to extract whatever materials have been absorbed in this pottery. Okay? And then you actually catch the molecules. And when you start doing these works, you catch materials that in the beginning you don't know what to do with them. I mean, I remember I was there when these results came before the article was published, and this group of researchers said, I don't know what to do with this because it never happened before that we have Southeastern materials, South Asian materials in the archaeology of the ancient Near East. Maybe this is wrong. Maybe we made a mistake. Let's do it again. You do it again and you get, this is the beautiful thing about science, it has repeatability. So you do it again and you get the same results. So you start to understand there is something here which you did not know. Okay, so the cinnamon, so it was a global world, without a doubt, okay? For the people of the Southern Levant, Egypt was not some exotic faraway land of wonders, but a real place from which they met people and commodities. There was a lot of commodities between Egypt and the Levant, which we don't always see in the archaeological record, okay? So Nile fish, we see now in the archaeological record, and the materials of ivories, the raw materials, we find them, and exotic animals, which we read about in the Assyrian annals, for example, and equids also, we read about equids from Egypt in the records of the Northern Levant. But of course, there was also papyrus, and there was also flax, linen, yeah, and incense, and gold, and these things will not remain for us to see. And on the other hand, things that were going from the Levant to Egypt, and we see it in the textual record, this is wine and oil and grains, okay? Egypt was dependent on the inundation of the Nile for the grains. Okay, this could happen or this could not happen. Sometimes it didn't happen, then there was a drought and everyone knows about this. In the valleys, in the Jezreel Valley, for example, Egypt had lands during the Late Bronze Age that produced grains. It was a more dependable supply of grains, and Egypt needed that always. Incense that was made of non-African materials, and so forth and so forth. Bitumen that was used in large quantities for the coffins, okay, for the whole mummification and coffin industries in Egypt. And of course, wood that was coming from Byblos, because wood in Egypt is something small and desert-like, and you can't do beautiful things from it if you like. And just a word about fish bones, yeah? Nile perch, Latus niloticus in its Latin way of speaking, was found all over the Near East, the ancient Near East, in the Late Bronze, but also in the Iron Age. Now we know that it even intensified during the Iron Age, and there are quite a few researchers that were done on that. Okay, so this is now the commodities, okay? And so with the commodities came news, yeah? And all this was spread by the constant movement of nomads, of pastoralists and traders. And as they moved around, they also brought with them a culture that was technologically advanced, yeah? And they widespread the fame of Egypt in this large geographical area. And this sounds a little bit like a modern description, but it is in fact a very accurate description of the Southern Levant in the Bronze and Iron Ages. So is ancient Egypt like the US? Is this what I'm trying to say? It has an equally huge domestic market. And this is a very important point that hasn't been discussed enough, I think. Okay. The very wide distribution of cultural exports, such as scarabs, amulets, figurines, attests to the fact that they were sold at such low rates that made their local production uneconomical. So if you produce it in Egypt, it's like made in China, yeah? Made in Egypt. You'd produce it at very low costs. So if I'm sitting here in Canaan and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I am going to make now a workshop for faience amulets, okay? And I'm going to have to build the workshop, I'm going to get the special sand that you need for this faience, I'm going to get it from who knows where, and I'm going to do the molds, and everyone's going to have to do the technology. But you know what? It costs nothing to buy it from Egypt, because they have such a huge domestic market, they can sell it for very small amounts. And I think this is the main reason why we find all these amulets all around southern Canaan, and regardless of the religious and the ideological question of what do they represent, okay? If you want an amulet, go get this cheap Egyptian one, and then you can call it whatever you want. And, you know, just to say a point about this is that the one period in the Levant that prompted local production on a large scale of scarabs, that's the Middle Bronze Age, the Middle Bronze 2A and 2B, coincided with the second intermediate period in Egypt, when fragmented Egypt lost its competitive edge as a huge domestic market, therefore increasing the cost of cultural exports, and then the Canaanites start making their own scarabs, okay? So this is on this equation of what happens when you have access to Egypt and what happens when you don't have access. Moving on to the next point, yeah? The development of a cultural imbalance. So the grandeur of Egypt's ancient culture needs no introduction. The remarkable kingdom that was established during the 3rd millennium BCE in the Nile Valley developed into an exceptional civilization that would last for over 3 millennia and capture the imagination of millions to this day. So you can imagine what happens in Canaan or in Judah when some pastoral nomads come and tell you about this incredible civilization or about this huge temple that is happening there in Egypt. I mean, this is like, you know, something out of this world for you. Okay, and this is why to fully understand Egypt's grandeur, you have to always compare it to what is happening in the neighbors. And what is happening in the neighbors is that the Southern Levant in the early centuries of the first millennium BCE saw a multitude of small kingdoms that emerged in the Levant, Neo-Hittite states along the Taurus Mountains, among which Carchemish was the most prominent, Phoenician city-states, Byblos, Arwad, Sidon, Tyre, on the coast of modern Lebanon and Syria, and the Aramean states of Luash, Hamat, and Damascus, and inland Syria, and of course Israel, Judah, the Philistine city-states in Palestine, and Ammon, Moab, Edom, to the east of the Jordan Valley. So during roughly these two centuries, these polities acted side by side as allies or competitors, and they were not, when you compare it to Egypt, they were not stable, okay? They were always competing one with each other. Whereas on the other side, you have an Egyptian state that is huge in comparison to the territory. And although some of you who have knowledge of Egyptian history know that in the third intermediate period in Egypt, the time we're talking about, was a time of changed perceptions of kingship, okay? There was sometimes more than one Egyptian king in Egypt in this time. And it was a less rigid concept that allowed multiple power centers. They were always dressed in the same pharaonic guise. So if you were looking from the outside, nothing changed in Egypt. It was still the pharaoh. He still had all the attributes. He still had all the institutions around him. So from the outside, people looked at Egypt. It looked exactly the same as it did. It did not change in its stability as it was outside the appearance. And all the institutions continued to work as they always did, and the developments were internal and local and not necessarily of any real effect beyond Egypt. The last point to consider on the cultural empire is the means by which it disseminates its culture. Indeed, it is so important that cultural imperialism is sometimes called media imperialism. And this is defined as the process whereby the ownership, structure, distribution of content of media in any one country are singly or together subject to substantially external pressures from the media interests of any other country or countries, without proportionate reciprocation of influence by the country so affected. So here I borrow from what is called the Fribourg school, yes, the idea of images as media and the high mobility level of glyptics and minor arts that are a key factor in the cultural influence in the ancient Near East. Yeah? So the fact that the transporters of the media are not necessarily Egyptian has no bearing on the result. Whether it was Phoenicians, Bedouins, or Egyptians that dispersed Egyptiaca across the southern Levant and the eastern Mediterranean does not change the effect of this distribution outside Egypt, as it is viewed in the local responses, the wide array of locally produced Egyptian-related artifacts discussed in the first part of our class today. So, we're already beyond time. So, there are just to show, yes, I showed already this examples of the kind of Egyptian seals and Hebrew seals that we find. Yeah? Okay, so before. Okay, so I would like to conclude. I skipped over the Shishak issue because we will see it in the fourth lesson. And just to summarize. Post-imperial Egyptian influences may have been the result of Egypt's tremendous cultural impact, which was evident in the Levant already from the early Bronze Age, but grew in intensity as time passed and the ancient Near East became increasingly globalized. In that sense, Egypt was a cultural empire that needed no territories because its fame and reputation transcended territorial boundaries. The role of personal encounters or commercial ties in the spread of Egyptian culture was secondary to the special status of Egypt and the Levant. The wide distribution of Egyptiaca in the Levant was the result of Egypt's unique cultural status. But Egyptiaca also functioned as tools of media imperialism, thus promoting the demand for Egyptian style even further. This demand was satisfied by a range of local products that either assimilated some Egyptian stylistic features or were used in what was conceived to be Egyptian tradition. This bubble burst in 664 BCE, when the territorial integrity of Egypt was breached by the advancing Assyrians. It is under this model that the Egyptian aspects in the Levant should be understood and analyzed, not a mere product of commercial exchange, not of just Egyptian interventions, but as the outcome of an extended fascination with the wonders of Egypt, a fascination that would endure for many centuries to come. Egyptian civilization surpassed its surrounding in all aspects for three millennia, building enormous monuments, reigning over the natural wilderness of the Nile, conquering death with cult and magic. It was a place exotic as it was miraculous. The eyes of the entire ancient Near East were turned towards Egypt, not to stand in the shadow of Pharaoh, but to bathe in its light. Thank you very much.